Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the third session of our New Look Advocacy Sector Conversation for July 2020. My name is Melissa Hayor, and I'm the coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we met and pay my respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We are now living in a new world with a new normal due to COVID-19. Like all of you, DAWU has had to review its program and the way we deliver our programs to you. We know that disability advocacy sector, its supporters, people with disabilities themselves, and the community and the government sector value the advocacy sector conversation. So we are pleased to be able to still bring this to you safely and online. We encourage your active participation today. Please type your questions in the Q&A box, and at the end of the session, I will be facilitating a Q&A session with our presenters. The captioning link will be found in the chat box. I hope you have all once again settled in comfortably, ready with your blankets and slippers and warm cups of tea for this last presentation of the July 2020 series. I would like to introduce our final presentation on improving interactions and communication with people with little or no speech. People with complex communication needs are often denied the right to make decisions about things in their lives that affect them. Just because a preference is expressed non-verbally, it doesn't mean that communication isn't happening. There are many ways to communicate other than speech, and many ways we can support those who do not use speech to communicate. Dr. Sheridan Forster and Dr. Meredith Prain are both speech pathologists and researchers with many years of experience working with people with complex and profound disabilities, including deafblindness. Both are accredited video interaction guidance practitioners through the Association of Video Interaction Guidance UK, and both have used this approach to foster improved interactions and relationships between people with complex disabilities and the family members and staff who support them. Please welcome Dr. Sheridan Forster and Dr. Meredith Prain from ABLE Australia.
Thank you, Melissa, for that introduction. We've got a lot to cover, so I'll get straight into it. So just what we're going to be covering today, I will start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting virtually today and pay respect to their elders past, present and emerging. And so we'll start by introducing ourselves, then because the whole session is on communication, we'll have a look at what is communication, and also just a snapshot of Australians with communication disabilities. We'll look at some of the causes of communication disability, and we'll be covering many modes of communication, the importance of relationships in communication, and we'll also be looking at strategies for working with people who communicate symbolically, and also strategies for working with people who communicate in non-symbolic ways. And we'll finish up looking at working with speech pathologists and have some time for questions at the end. So just in introducing ourselves, I'll hand over to you, Sherry, to introduce yourself.
My name is Sheridan Forster. I have a speech impairment that will resolve as the session progresses. And you may notice that I have a variety of tics as well, which again will resolve, so they'll become somewhat less distracting, I hope. I also have a top lip that's double its normal size at the moment because I have an allergy, so just give me patience and love with my speech at the moment. I am a speech pathologist. I've been working and interested in people with profound intellectual and multiple disability for the past 20 years. Handing to Meredith.
Thanks, Sherry. Even with a swollen top lip, your contributions are always exceptional. So we look forward to hearing from you through the presentation. So my name's Meredith Prain, and just last month I clocked over 25 years since I started working with people with complex disabilities. So yes, I was only 3 years old when I started. it's an incredibly challenging and interesting area, and I still learn from every client that I meet and work with, and have learned a huge amount over the time that hopefully I can share some of that with everyone today. Okay.
I think we can both say that we've both been learning for 20 and 25 years rather than doing,
practicing.
Maybe.
It's true. It's constant, constant learning. So launching into what is communication, and we're using a model today from Money et al., who published this in a publication from the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists in the United Kingdom. And this is a model of inclusive communication and highlights the many factors that go into inclusive communication. So on the outer circle is community, and it's important that there's always a minimum of at least two people in a communication partnership and interaction. But we are part of a community that share language or ways of communicating together, and that will help to frame and shape the methods that we're using. And we have shared experience of culture and context. The next circle is environment. So the environment has a significant impact on our communication. If it's noisy and somebody has trouble blocking out background sound, or if they have hearing impairment or are hard of hearing, that can significantly impact on their ability to communicate. And even thinking about what objects or cues you have in the environment to support the communication interaction is significant as well. Next, we have the individual and all the factors that they bring to the interaction. We need a means, a way of communicating that's shared by both parties. We need a reason for communicating, and we need opportunities. And I think as we talk about people with profound intellectual and multiple disabilities later in the presentation, often those opportunities are very limited or lacking. So making sure that we're regularly creating opportunities for communication. So just over on the left, we've got, you need at least two people. We can't communicate in isolation. And it is a partnership. Both people have a responsibility within the interaction to help it to work out. We need joint attention or a shared focus. So that's the topic that we're communicating about. And sometimes with people who don't speak, it's harder to work out what the topic is. So paying attention to what the individual is focusing on is really important. It might be what they're looking at. They might be very still when they're tuning into something. So being very attentive and clear that we're sharing attention and sharing the topic. We also need a shared mode. So if I was in France trying to use English language, that might not work so well. So I might use the environment and things in the environment to point to in a shop, pointing to what I want. If my language isn't working, and trusting that they'll understand the gesture of a point and what I'm pointing to. So making sure both people understand the mode is really important. And another important thing to consider is that we often think of the active person in the interaction as the one who is sending the message, but it's important to be mindful that both people, the sender and the receiver of the message are both active at all times. So the receiver is taking in the message, processing what it means, working out what their response will be. So it's a very active process, whether you're the sender or the receiver of the message.
And I think one of the things that Meredith and I have both found through being researchers, traditionally, we really like to look at the idea of the sender and the receiver, the person who initiates and the person who responds. But actually, if you look really close at videos of interaction, it can be really difficult to know sometimes who the sender and the receiver is, or who initiates and who responds, because we're constantly reading each other.
Great point, Sheridan. I know I've filmed somebody interacting and with a person with a disability, and she said, it looks like I'm dancing with my uncle at a wedding, and it's very difficult to tell who is leading that interaction. It's a really good point, Sherry. So just looking at Australians with communication disability and looking at the Bureau of Statistics survey of disability, ageing and carers from 2015, we see that 5% of Australians have a communication disability. So it's pretty high numbers. They then classify them into mild, moderate, severe and profound limitations. And so when you look at people with profound, and it says people who cannot understand or be understood at all and always need help. So I think hopefully through the presentation today, one of our key messages is that all people can communicate, and it just takes a skilled, sensitive partner. So just being mindful of that. And I think we're going to focus particularly on those with moderate and, with severe and profound communication disabilities today. So looking at causes of communication disability, it's useful to use the World Health Organization's impairment classification and functioning.
loss on that one.
I know it as well.
We
as
can move
any,
past that one.
Classification functioning. So. You can look at, they look at body function and structure, and any issues with body structure and function. So you can look at sensory impairment. So that might be deafness, where you are not able to hear speech. Or if you're blind and somebody points and says, that thing over there, that is not going to be meaningful to a blind person. So having a sensory impairment will impact on your ability to understand and interpret speech. Having a physical issue such as cerebral palsy or cleft lip or palate can impact on your ability to speak, not necessarily your ability to understand speech, but the communication method that you use. And also cognitive impairment will significantly impact on your ability to both understand and to use speech. You can also have combinations of two or all three of those to create a more complex communication disability. And it's useful, the model of the ICF, looking at participation. So in this model, we have the body function and structure and any impairment. Then activities being undertaken and the participation, also with environmental factors and personal factors impacting on the person's ability to participate. So I'm just going to give two examples to highlight how this model would work. If you think about someone who's hard of hearing, so that's the body function and structure, there's an issue with their hearing, and they might be in a very busy shopping centre trying to have a conversation with somebody. Now, take into account personal factors. They may be quite a passive person or a non-assertive person and having a lot of trouble hearing. And so they might just sort of be nodding and not really fully following the conversation. So that limits their participation in that interaction. If they have the personal factor of being more assertive, and they might say, can you look at me when you're speaking, or can you repeat that, or can we go somewhere quieter, that will improve and enhance their ability to participate in that conversation. Another example, a person with a profound intellectual and multiple disability, so both physical and cognitive impairments, and perhaps cortical vision impairments, so all three areas are impaired. In a familiar and quiet environment will be likely to function better. They might be doing a cooking activity, and the personal factors, they may have done that activity many times before. They have a communication partner who knows them really well and can present the food and ingredients for cooking very slowly, so they have time to focus and participate. So taking into all of those into account helps the person to participate more. And I think, Sherry, you've got some examples as well.
I think you can never, the impairment doesn't dictate the participation. So I was working in a group home, and one of the women had cerebral palsy and a very severe impairment, motor impairment, couldn't create any words, but had amazing social skills and could participate in the community so well and say where she, or through yes, no questions and through eye gaze, actually direct me to another suburb where to go. Whereas one of her housemates who didn't have that level of severity of impairment, he had speech, but he actually had a lot of impairment in social communication skills. And he was difficult to spend time with because he just spent a lot of time complaining. So he actually had a lot more participation restriction than what the person with the more severe impairment literally had.
Thanks, Sherry. Yeah. And I'm pretty confident ICF is the International Classification Framework. Sorry about my momentary block there. So we've talked about this a little bit already, that communication are two different sides of the same coin. So communication is made up of understanding, so the taking in information, understanding another person, and being able to express yourself. So we talk about receptive communication, receiving and understanding, and expressive communication, so sending the messages. So with understanding, we might be able to hear words and understand words, but tone of voice also has an impact on the message. Facial expression and gesture, pictures and writing might also be used to supplement or be in isolation, but those are used to help send the message so that the person understands in that way. In terms of expression, so we've got signing here. So signing also is a way of understanding meaning, and we can express with words, with speech, which written or spoken, with signs, single signs or whole sign languages, also with gestures, facial expression and vocalization. And we'll talk a lot more about these different modes. But it's just really important to remember that an individual may have a different way of receiving information and understanding than they do of expressing. So just because somebody is able to hear and understand speech doesn't mean they necessarily will be using speech. And also, just because someone can hear doesn't mean they can understand speech necessarily. So it's really important not to make assumptions or presume competence or incompetence at first sight of the person.
Mm. And I think quite often what an area, a bugbear for me is when people's communication expression is described as nonverbal. Because for me, all nonverbal says is that they're not using words to express themselves. It says nothing about the person's level of comprehension or their understanding. So a baby is nonverbal, but Stephen Hawking was nonverbal. So I tend to avoid that term like the plague, except in the cases where people have self-decided to say that they are nonverbal. That's a definition that they've chosen to use. I just think there is too much of a tendency, whether it be in nursing homes or day centres, if people say the person is nonverbal, there's too much of a tendency to jump to the assumption that that means that the person is non-understanding.
It's a really good point, Sheridan. And I think just building on that point about terminology and what individuals prefer to use for themselves, Sheridan and I will be using a variety of different terminology today. And we both fully recognise that the terms that we use may not be the preferred terms of individuals. And it's completely up to the individual to decide which terminology works best for them and how they want to identify. So the terms that we're using are not necessarily the terms that others would be using, and we completely accept and acknowledge that, but you sort of can't avoid terminology when you're trying to describe different populations of people. So I just wanted to make a quick note of that.
I tend to try to just use as concrete terminology as possible. So I might say a person who does not use or seem to understand speech.
Mm-hmm. Which is really beautiful and clear. Yeah. So looking at different modes of communication, we've got so literacy is sort of considered one of the highest orders of communication, because if a person is literate, they have a lot more options for being able to express their thoughts and ideas and anything they're wanting to get across. So that it's quite a high level skill, but even a person who has no speech and who has literacy skills like Stephen Hawking can, you know, write a PhD or write a book, contribute at all levels of society. So literacy is a very powerful skill to have if you have the cognitive capacity required for literacy skills. And with literacy, we have print options, which for people with a vision impairment might be large print, or braille, or finger spelling for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. So I guess that's a range of people who may not be able to speak but still can express all the different ideas and messages that they have. Next, if we look at speech, and other language, so speech in any language or Auslan Sign Language or any other sign language, there are still a lot of abstract ideas, but you would know that young children learn to speak before they can read and write. So it's that step before developing literacy, but you're still able to understand with speech a lot of concepts if you are able to understand speech. When we look at keyword signs, pictures and photographs, these are all ways of expressing an idea or a concept in a more concrete sort of a way. And when we speak, our word disappears very quickly. So if you have trouble holding a concept or that spoken word in your mind, which a lot of people with cognitive impairments, if you offer three choices, do you want milk, juice or Coke? That might be too many words. As soon as you've said milk and you've moved on to juice, they've forgotten milk. But if you can hold the three pictures or even just two pictures, it gives them longer, the images stay there for longer so they can look and process that information. Also, if you're talking about a drink, do you want a drink? As soon as I say drink, that disappears. But a key sign, so holding up a cup, lingers a bit longer and also looks more like the real thing. And a picture or a photograph look more like the real thing than the word drink. Doesn't really have much bearing on what an actual drink is. So those are other ways of communicating and sharing information with a person, and a way that they can share information by holding out a picture or holding out an object to express what it is that they're wanting, that might be more meaningful for someone with a cognitive impairment. So all of these ways are considered symbolic. They're symbols to represent ideas, concepts, or things in our environment. Then there's ways that are non-symbolic, that people with more profound intellectual disability will be using to express themselves. So we look at vocalizations, facial expression, body language, and really any behavior. So even a person's breath pattern can be tuned into to show that we're paying attention to that individual, and any sort of movement that you can engage in with the person to indicate that you've seen that movement and that behaviour. But we'll get a bit more onto that down the track.
Meredith just brought up the idea of profound intellectual disability, and I think that's just a nice quick segue onto thinking about profound intellectual disability, because in Australia we don't tend to use the term a lot. We tend to think that to suggest that somebody has a very severe intellectual disability, some people feel that that might be a value statement on the person, that we're suggesting that they're a lesser person. But Mary and I are both stating that there are people who have a profound intellectual disability, which means they have a profound difficulty with concentrating, with attending, with remembering, with problem solving. And we need to understand how they understand the world. So we'll often use the term profound intellectual or multiple disability. And on its most gross level, and it might be discomforting for a lot of people to think of this, where we are looking at the skills that are similar to what we might be seeing with an infant, but then an infant who probably also has a hearing impairment, a vision impairment, medication, and a multitude of other things. So acknowledging the different experience of life that is held by a person with a profound intellectual disability. Mary, were you going to talk about keyword sign, or was I? I forgot.
I think you talk about keyword sign, Sherry. If
you do. Okay. So just quickly. So for those who understand symbols, and that would be a person without an intellectual disability, a person with a mild intellectual disability, many people with a moderate intellectual disability, and some people with a severe intellectual disability may understand keyword signs. And the principle of keyword sign is that you sign and speak at the same time, that you sign only the key words. So you might only be signing one sign in a sentence to represent the whole idea. So do you want a drink? Only requires one sign. It's also using your body language and your facial expression and directionality and symbols where they're appropriate, and some use of finger spelling. So it's interesting. The sign for toilet, which is in the image on the right, is pointing your finger into your hand. Now, unless you know that that's a sign for tea, that actually resembles nothing to do with a toilet, I don't think. So you can think about the complexity of how does this relate? But there are a lot of signs that do look like what they're meant to, like drink, like eat. And the best signs are the ones that are most obvious. So don't get worried if you don't know any signs, because what you can come up with to augment your message is most important. That people might also be using objects or pictures or technology. And again, thinking about toilet. For some people, the sign for toilet might not be the finger stuck into the hand. It might actually be a hand being rubbed against their side or down their side, because when you go to the toilet, you take your pants down. It feels like this. So not everybody is going to adapt to the same signs as everybody else or be able to use the same signs as everybody else. Similarly with pictures, so we have four different images here, and one has some objects on it. And one of them is a belt buckle for the idea of going home. Now, if you use that regularly enough, maybe somebody will, a person might be able to make the link that when I touch this belt buckle, it means that I'm going home. But again, for a lot of people, does going in the van mean? What does it feel like on their body? For a lot of people, it's actually a strap going across their body. So a strap might actually make more sense if that person never actually interacts with the belt buckle. Then we've got much more complex things like different sort of pictures. And we could talk about the picture for death. How do you represent death in a way that's meaningful? For some people, they learn an accepted picture for death. So some people use these pod communication books, which are able to capture all the sorts of words or as many sorts of words as they can to be able to have a conversation using the booklet. And there's some wonderful videos of people using pod communication boards, books to be able to express themselves. There's electronic devices, from the most simple ones that have a single message recorded on it. But again, check your presumptions about what that actually means to the person who's pressing it. So if the person presses a button and it gives you a lecture on astrophysics, does it mean the person understands astrophysics, or does it mean that the person understands that pressing a button makes a sound? So you need to be able to understand where that person's understanding is and how it might serve. And then apps, communication apps are hugely popular. The bottom images of the app ProLoCo2Go, which is a very popular app, and it works really well for a lot of people. So strategies with symbolic communicators. Mary, did you want to talk about this one?
Sure. So I'll just touch briefly on talking mats, which is a really useful strategy with people who have trouble understanding complex speech, and it's a useful strategy if you're trying to have a more complex discussion or make a difficult decision that's got a lot of components to it. So a good example of a time when you might use talking mats is if you're looking at moving house, moving out of home into a group home or some other living arrangement. You might get all the images that you need that are important and will be necessary in the conversation. So you might have an image showing that the house is close to public transport, an image of family, an image of day service or other activities that the person likes doing. You might have a picture of a house or a flat, something with stairs. And the person can look and rank or look at all the things that they can consider when moving into a house. Do they want to live by themselves? Do they want to live with people? Is it important that they live close to their family? Or is it more important to them that they live close to a friend or some other preferred activity? What is most important to that individual? And by mapping it out in pictures, it's easier for them to make some of those complex decisions and rank things and put links to other things that are also important. And you can take a photo at the end to document the discussion so that it's really clear and they can go back to it and perhaps change or build on it at a later time. So that's just an example of using talking mats, but you need to prepare the images, You can also, just using pen and paper and drawing some of the things, you can add things as they come up. So, but having it all there in a very concrete way in front of the person so they can shuffle images and ideas around is a useful way of helping with more complex discussions and decision making. I'll also just touch on interpreters and communication guides because I work with people with deaf blindness. A lot of people with deaf blindness, but also people with intellectual disabilities, often need what we might say human mediated support. So having someone who knows their way of communicating as well as the person they're communicating with. So today we have Auslan interpreters who are interpreting English to Auslan, but would also interpret Auslan to English. So making sure that the message is interpreted and relayed back and forth. Communication guides with people with deaf blindness are not interpreters. They might be familiar with Auslan, but they can assist out in the community. So, you know, when the person is shopping, if they need some information, if there's an interaction with a shopkeeper or a person at the checkout, that the communication guide can help to bridge that interaction and sign and relay what the individual has said and then voice for the person who's deafblind that is using signing that the person in the community wouldn't understand. But I think also staff who know people with intellectual disabilities very well can also support that interaction with others by mediating and interpreting the behaviours of the individual with an intellectual disability, but also relaying the information to the person with the intellectual disability.
And I think in one of my recent chapters, not wanting to plug, but I called them ambassadors, you know, staff and advocates are ambassadors for a person. And the role of an ambassador is not to sell a utopia, but to gain a shared meaning. So there's so many great tools out there for people with mild and moderate and severe intellectual disabilities when it comes to advocacy. And it just reminds me when you say that, I recommend if people look up the look up Involve Me, if they type in Involve Me PMLD. So in the UK, PMLD is the term that is used for profound multiple learning disabilities. And the Involve Me tool, it's probably about 10 years old now, but it is a tool specifically thinking about people with profound intellectual disability and how advocates can work with them. And I think, Mary, I'm just going to steal this slide from you on the importance of relationships, because I think one of the things that comes up most clearly in the Involve Me tool is that you cannot advocate with somebody if you have not got a relationship with them. And Mary and I would probably agree, but not everybody, that you cannot understand somebody's communication or assess their communication unless you have communicated with them. Assessments by observation alone don't cut it, in my opinion. There's a different sort of understanding that you get of a person when you try to genuinely engage. So the importance of relationships, that this whole communication thing is about relationships. Communication is never, ever individual. Assessments of communication can never be individual because you don't see communication in a bubble. It's all about building respect and trust through interaction. And that's what a lot of the tools that I'm going to move on to are focusing on. Did you want to add anything on that one, Mary?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
I guess just that, you know, interaction, no matter how fleeting, any interaction, there's always that opportunity in every interaction and every moment of interaction to be building trust and respect. And the way that you bring yourself to the interaction has significant impact on the quality of the relationship down the track. I think that's true for any interaction and any relationship, but definitely with people with profound intellectual and multiple disabilities, because those interactions can be more challenging. So something to really pay attention to: how are you going about respecting and engaging in a way that's meaningful with that individual?
And sometimes that's also about acknowledging your own discomfort. And we don't talk about it enough that one of the biggest barriers for people with profound intellectual disability is the discomfort, the unsurety of communication partners, the desire not to insult, it's a confusing land, and that needs to be acknowledged because it is hard. So
I think just something on that, one of the things that makes it very challenging is, as Sheridan said, a lot of these adults have the cognitive capacity of, you know, a 6 to 9 month old infant, and they might be 40 or 50. So engaging with someone in the same way that you would engage with a very young baby or child is really profoundly challenging to many people.
Yep, which brings us very well. There's three areas that I just like to talk about: intensive interaction, the hanging out program, and video interaction guidance. Firstly, intensive interaction, which was developed in the 80s in a hospital school in the United Kingdom by Melanie Nine and Dave Hewitt. And they had people in the institution who weren't making any gains, who weren't coming to the table to do activities. And they re-looked at how communication normally develops, how people usually learn to communicate. And they looked at what happened in parent or mother-infant interaction. They came up with what was called the fundamentals of communication. And in intensive interaction, these are the goals that you're looking at. And we often, you know, oh, how many years have you seen on somebody's general service plan the person will learn 5 signs? And it hasn't happened. But how often do you see these sort of goals? So the things they have here: enjoying being with another person, developing the ability to attend to that person, concentration and attention span, learning to do sequences of activity with a person, taking turns in exchanges of behaviour, sharing space, using and understanding eye contact, facial expressions, physical contacts, other nonverbal communications, vocalising and using vocalisations meaningfully, including speech, and learning to regulate and control arousal levels, which is actually one of the primary things in any parent-infant interaction, is your attempt to regulate the arousal level of the person, the baby that you're with. You're trying to excite them, or you're trying to calm them. And the last element, lots and lots of emotional elements. So these interactions, intensive interactions, can look quite different from what we see as typical interactions, but they've definitely been recognised in the United Kingdom and slowly in Australia as a valid way of being with people with profound intellectual and multiple disability and other disabilities. So can I get you to play the first video for me? So we have Dylan, and it's a video that's from the Intensive Interaction website that you can have a look at. Dylan's sitting cross-legged on a couch and he's rocking back and forth, sort of gazing into the sky, flicking at his nose, pulling a sock, seemingly not engaged with the world around him. And this is often what we see for many hours for some people. Now we see a partner who's sitting down on the floor. Her face is lower than his. He's making a sound and she's repeating that sound. She's letting him know that she heard that sound so that he knows that she knows what he knows. There's different sorts of sounds. And you can hear perhaps a different sort of mood that is expressed with the sounds. through pace. He gazes at her and smiles. This is somebody who does want to engage, but it's incredibly difficult. And his modes, his means for engagement are very difficult. She's also maintaining contact just through having her hand on his knee the whole time. And he lifts it up and takes it up. And we've certainly met some people who find it very hard to put themselves in a positive headspace watching that video and might say, oh, he wants her to go away when he lifts the hand away. And we would challenge that, well, it's just part of the conversation. I want to show the – yeah, Mary?
I was just going to say I've been engaging with people using intensive interaction for a long time, and I've had moments where I've thought, am I just annoying them? I'm not sure. And I guess one thing I have discovered over the years, if someone really doesn't want you doing something, they'll mm-hmm. tell you. And so it's made me more confident that people invariably will let you know if you've gone too far with them. And we all have the right to negotiate. We all have interactions that we're not enjoying. That's part of human life. And so it's okay to, as long as your intent is to engage and interact, it's okay to get it a bit wrong.
I think one area that irks me a little bit with intensive interaction is a lot of focus on fun, having fun together. And I think it's just as important that we share sad times together, that we validate pain together, that we share those negative feelings rather than always trying to make somebody feel better, saying, oh, it's hard, isn't it? And that's one of the most amazing tools with a lot of people that I use with a lot of people with autism. When they start showing through their body language that they're a bit distressed, and instead of interpreting that as go away, I interpret that as bloody hell. So what I will say, and this is often if a person does understand speech, I might say, it's hard, isn't it? And you see this change in body language where the person feels understood. The power of actually feeling understood by another person is unwordable. Sorry, I forgot my word. Anyway, let's have a look at this other video of me with Christopher a number of years ago. So Christopher is in a wheelchair and he's leaning back in it, and I'm sitting quite close to him. Now, intensive interaction is not always close, but sometimes it is, and sometimes it needs to be if a person has a vision impairment. Sometimes it's across the room. I'm squeezing his hand because he's squeezing his hand. That's where his focus is. That's where his attention is. His attention is now the sound. And I repeat that. I let him know he is heard and respected. My hand is available to him so he can reach it out. So you can only say what is available to you. You can only say, give me your hand, if a hand is available to you. So I do a lot of placing my hand in positions where the person can grab it should they want to. And it's a way of them saying, oh, you. I rub his knee. And it's like he's pausing and thinking about it. He does a flick on my face and I make it into a bit of a game. And then he does a burp. Now, an important thing with this, actually, I'll wait till it stops. I'm sort of rubbing my mouth on his hand. And he's, again, stealing and thinking about what I'm doing. And that's his dad in the background also saying, oh. Now, a person can only take turns when a person can actually do the thing required in the turn. Now, if I just use speech with Christopher, we have no capacity for him to take turns. He is not going to use speech back to me. But if I use his sounds, we have capacity to take turns. He can make his sound. I can make his sound. I can make it louder or softer and shape it and give it different feelings and expressions. We have shared meaning. So something that I developed, oh, more than 10 years or so ago now, is called the Hanging Out Program. And it took a little bit of a paradigm shift because I was doing my research and I asked a support worker, do you still spend that nice time together? And she said to me, when the work is finished. And that was really profound for me and it shifted my whole thinking from teaching support workers what to do to saying that interaction is not an optional extra of the work of support workers. Interaction is the core role that you need to find 10 minutes each day and give a person total attention. Write down and reflect on what happened. Celebrate if the person stayed awake during that 10 minutes, or the person gazed at you or reached out to you or remained in the room with you. So I'd recommend that people have a look at the HOP program on my website and think about, do the people they support or do you as an advocate actually sit down and give the person 10 minutes of 100% attention?
Another aspect I know a lot of staff have said to me, we interact with them all day long, but their version of interacting is, hey, Meredith, how's it going? Oh, I like your top today, Meredith. It looks great. Okay, Meredith, time to go to bowling, which is not actually interactive. It's someone being spoken to all day long. And one of the keys of the Hanging Out program and intensive interaction is that the individual gets a chance to take the lead. It's pretty rare that these individuals are the ones leading the interaction, deciding the topic, deciding the mode. So that's one of the key differences about these approaches to other approaches. And that it's social. Purely social, it's not functional. And if you look at any measure of quality of life, personal relationships and social interaction are always features of any quality of life tool. And so we need to be looking at how we build and develop social interactions and relationships for any individual we're working with.
Which is a great segue to video interaction guidance. And this is a technique that Mary and I have been using for a number of years that came from the United Kingdom. What it involves is, say, a person with a disability, a support worker, and a guide. And the guide will meet with the support worker and say, okay, are there any goals that you have? And quite often they don't have goals because they don't know what could be different. The guide will then video 10 minutes of just a natural interaction and then look at that video and find those gems, find those moments when there are connection, like you could see in those two videos in intensive interaction, but it doesn't have to be intensive interaction. So they look for those moments and then they share those video clips with the support worker and guide the support worker to be able to deconstruct them, to say what's working, what's happening. And often we use what's called the principles of attuned interaction and guidance, the idea of being attentive, encouraging initiatives. And we're looking for these sort of things, which you can find on my website as well, or the video interaction guidance website. You're looking for evidence of these things happening. Now, people might think it's a bit of a no-brainer, being attentive, but actually having somebody sit down and gaze at you and attend to what your foot is doing or attend to how you're breathing can be very, very rare for a lot of the people that we support. And we can see when support workers do sit down and attend to the person, the response of the person with a disability is different. The interaction is better. So we'll look at other ways. to try and build in that just showing the person that you're attentive to them. There's a wonderful concept in video interaction guidance called receiving. And receiving means the person knows that they've been understood. So I might see Christopher doing something, but unless I let him know that I know what he knows, he doesn't know that I knew what he was doing. It's like sending out a text message and not knowing whether the person actually received it or not. Communication doesn't happen unless you know that you've been heard. So what happens with VIG is quite often three or four cycles of just sitting down and watching these videos can make massive shifts in the interaction, in the ability to see what is working. Because we believe there are things that are working, but often they're severely overlooked or devalued, and we need to have conversations about that. So, Mary, working with speech pathologists.
And I'm mindful of the time, so I'll whip through this quickly. So hopefully you now are aware that it is really important to find out what is the level of ability of the person that you're advocating for in terms of what do they understand receptively, as well as what's the best way for them to express themselves. So a speech pathologist is well placed to undertake that assessment, and will have a range of assessment tools they can use to work that out. And they'll be able to make recommendations around ways to support the individual's understanding and ways to support their ability to express themselves. In terms of finding a speech pathologist, there's a Find a Speech Pathologist search on the Speech Pathology Australia website. But as Sheridan mentioned, people with profound intellectual and multiple disabilities make up a fairly small percentage of the population of people with disabilities. And a lot of speech pathologists won't have experience working with that population. So it's definitely worth asking if the speech pathologist does have experience, and even asking if they have used intensive interaction or are familiar with intensive interaction. That's a good indicator that they have worked with this particular group before and will have some good ideas about strategies for working with them. That just because there is a bit of a shortage, it can be hard to find speech pathologists at the moment. I would also recommend working with creative arts therapists, so with art, dance and music, all who are also often very skilled at non-language based interactions and will be well trained at being very observant and responding to the behaviours of the individual. So occupational therapists as well, and physiotherapists. So, but I guess the key thing is that they have experience working with this group of people. Sherry?
Okay, so I just want to quickly touch on, it's well worth of you to have a look at, and when you ask a speech pathologist, this is the sort of things that you want to be able to see in a communication assessment. They're called the five communication standards that came out of a lot of, as a result of a lot of the abuse in care homes and with people with challenging behaviour. And what the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists said was needed was a detailed description of how best to communicate with individuals. You need to see the individual in the report, not just a cookbook of the person. You need services to demonstrate how they support individuals with communication needs to be involved in decisions about their care. What is the way? How do they use supported decision making? What is the best way to find out their preferences? What do staff value and use competently the best approaches to communication with individuals they support? So are they using intensive interaction, or are they just using speech at the person all the time and actually never really meeting the person on a shared basis of meaning? Does the service create opportunities and relationships and environments that make individuals want to communicate? Do they actually sit down on the couch with the person or on the floor with the person? Are the individuals supported to understand and express their needs in relation to their health and well-being? as well. So that's what you want to see in a good report. And maybe if you're referring to a speech pathologist, share this with them, that this is what you might want to see. So our key take-home points, the key 4 points, community comprehension skills can be different from expressive skills. Now, for a lot of people, I won't, you know, you don't know when you first meet them, and I might say to the person, I don't know what you're understanding right now, but I'm here to try and find it out. Engagement with people requires you to understand, how do I need to be in order to be with you? So each person that you're working with, you need to have an idea. How do you need to modify what you're doing, whether it be the amount of eye contact that you're using, the distance that you sit from the person, the complexity of speech that you're using? How do you need to be in order to be with them? You can find out more about the person's communication skills, and that everybody can communicate. So, do we have any questions?
Thank you so much for an excellent presentation. I'm sure everyone else found it as fascinating as I did. And I was thinking to myself now that we have a mandatory math order in Victoria, how complex it must be for those with communication needs. So as a deaf person myself, it's hard now, but I can only imagine what other people would struggle with that. So I've got some questions coming in. So if you would like to ask your question, just type it in the question and answer box, and I'll try my best to get through as many as I can. Also, all the resources as well as where to find online classes will be on our website later on. So I see we've got our first question up. So the person needs to understand the person's intention as well as in terms of understanding. This is a massive problem, not only for those with autism, but theory of mind difficulties. Not just words or non-verbal cues, communication, need to understand the context and the reason behind not, which is... So having so much trouble.
Social communication, I think, on that one.
Sorry, guys, my computer's not well with me today. But, yeah, if you can answer that question, that would be great.
I think that one's largely a comment, but it makes me reflect back on the work of Tony Atwood when he talks about speaking Aspergeries and how do I need to be in order to be with you, person with Asperger's. Some of the common experience things, like not thinking that the person necessarily understands the sentence in the same way that you understand the sentence. So if we think about the phrase taxis here, a person needs to be able to deconstruct. Taxis here means I need to get my bag, walk out the door and get in the taxi. But if you just look at that literally for a person with autism, taxis here is like, yeah, cool, taxi. So, yeah, we've got to understand that not everybody thinks the same way that we do. And sometimes we have to say things or do things in a more explicit way to actually get shared meaning. Sometimes we need to say, I am leaving the room now, but I'll come back in 5 minutes, or I'm coming to speak with you for an hour, and then I will speak to the staff. Because if the person's not reading your mind the same way that you intend it to be, they don't know what you're thinking. So, yeah, we need to understand that not everybody understands what we understand.
I also note they mentioned social interaction at the end, and I guess I touched on that earlier, that there's such a strong focus on functional, like getting people to say they need to go to the toilet or that they want food. And sometimes that social aspect of interaction and communication is missed. So it's really important to make sure there's time every day for social interaction and that sharing back and forth rather than just the functional communication.
And sometimes we have to adjust our concept of what is socially right and socially fine. That sometimes I remember an example of a man saying to me, or I said, one thing I like in the UK is how they do the postal system, which can get a letter to your house through the postcode. And he started reciting from AA, whatever, Aberdeen, all of the postcodes in the UK. And I said to him, I don't want to know all the postcodes in UK. And he said, okay. So sometimes we have to adjust, and sometimes our neurotypical social qualities are pretty crap, and the qualities, the Aspie world qualities, are actually a lot more sensible.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that. I think we only have time for one more question. So straight on to the next question, please. Okay, so I'm very interested in your take on the controversy on the use of AAC, where someone physically supports someone to use the AAC. I know this is a very tricky one to answer really quickly.
Mary, shall I take that?
Sure, over to you.
I have no fear. So this is touching on the idea, I think, of facilitated communication, which is when one person supports the hand or touches another person's body while they are pointing to a communication device. Now, they might be touching the person like that and pulling back. They might be touching the person's arm. They might be touching the person's shoulder. A lot of research has suggested that it is more so the person who is touching who is directing the message than the person who is moving their arm. Now, I think there are varying circumstances of this. There are certainly people with cerebral palsy that I know who need that physical support of their arm because of their physical movement problems to be able to type. And they can clarify and say, they can confirm whether the message was theirs or not. There are people who cannot clearly confirm outside of the support whether that was their message or not. And there have been court cases, there have been jailing, there have been claims of rape, assault, all made through this facilitated communication thing. It is a very controversial area.
I would
completely
say
agree.
In a nutshell, it depends on the individual with the communication disability, and it also depends on the facilitator, and it's a case by case situation. I think there are times when it's really effective and useful, and times where it's possibly not being used in a useful way. So I think that there's not a hard and fast answer to it, and it's case by case.
And certainly there's been cases where I've assessed a person and suggested that they have a profound intellectual disability, that they don't have speech, that they are not producing spelling, and I've had another professional say they have been spelling using facilitated communication. So, yeah.
It's a very tricky one. Thank you for that. And I'm really, really sorry because there's some really good questions that have come out, but we've run out of time. So thank you so much, Dr. Sheridan Foster and Dr. Meredith Crane, for your presentation today and the fantastic work that you and Able Australia do. So, everybody, the recording of this webinar, slides and resources mentioned today will be uploaded onto the DAWU website in a few weeks. Thank you to Expression Australia for the Auslan interpreters and captioners for their hard work today. Thank you to Show Division for bringing this production to you today. Please stay safe, wear your masks, wash those hands and stay home. See you next time.